Talk Radio.
Good evening, Survivor, followers, and all of our listeners that are continuing to tune in to our TBI One Love podcast that, as you know, is spreading our positive form of hope, inspiration, and education to those that have been touched by a brain injury, as well as awareness and prevention. We hope everyone has been enjoying the start of the new year so far, and even though we're halfway through the first official month of the new year, hard to believe, we have such an exciting guest tonight. I am honored to announce that we are getting ready to have a deep conversation with Dr. Ellen Rastami. She is a consultant, neurosurgeon, and associate professor in neurosurgery. Dr. Rastami completed her MD PhD at the Karolinska Institute with the title Traumatic Brain Injury in Humans and Animal Models, and that was obtained in Sweden. This is a collaboration in the NIH where she worked with Professor Jordan Grafman on Vietnam veterans with head injury, studied the impact of genetic background on outcome following TBI. She then completed her neurosurgical training at Uppsala University Hospital. She is currently consultant neurosurgeon and associate professor and holds the prestigious Wellenberg Clinical Fellow position. She is also vice chair of the EANS Neurotrauma and a board member of the WFNS Neurotrauma as well. I know we just listed a lot, but she is a phenomenal difference maker that has a passion with her work in helping educate others and make a difference with traumatic brain injury. So I am honored to not only have her on the show tonight, but also she is taking time out of her busy schedule, calling in all the way from Sweden. So I hope everyone is really excited, not only to obtain more information, but learn key elements that are very positive for us brain injury survivors, as well as those that are learning to make a difference as well. So without further ado, let's get the show started. Dr. Rastami, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rastami, for taking time out of your busy schedule on the other side of the world and being on tonight's show.
It's my honor. It's really a pleasure to be able to talk to you.
Well, you heard me give a brief intro about all the amazing work you do and your passion. Why don't you go ahead and we'll start our show off with you giving a little bit more information about yourself.
Yes, so I, as you mentioned, I work currently as a neurosurgeon, and my passion when it comes to my research is traumatic brain injury. And what I really try to understand is that why some people who suffer from traumatic brain injury becomes maybe as an example as yourself, and why others do not recover as well. And can we learn something from that and try to help those people that do not recover very well? It was so fascinating for me when I, me and you got in contact, and I saw this, because I don't know any details about your story and your medical history, but I saw this picture of you that showed you were in hospital and supposedly just in the acute phase where you had your traumatic brain injury. And what I could see was that you have been going through this hemicronectomy, and which means that you had a real severe TBI. And I guess your listeners are from broad backgrounds, so just give a short explanation for that. As you know, TBI is, classified as very broadly into mild, moderate, and severe from the initial, in the acute phase. So we use this tool, the Glasgow Coma Scale, which basically tells us how conscious you are, etc. And then we can put you in these three different categories. And this is a very useful tool for us, because we can then in the immediately assess and try to decide what we need to do with the patient. And when you have this severe type of TBI, then you're unconscious, and then we need to secure the airway and help you with the ventilator, and most of the time also perform a surgery. So we also monitor the intracranial pressure, the pressure of the brain, in order to, if something happens, get an indication to prevent or intervene, so we can help the patient to not die from the high intracranial pressure. So we do different types of things when we get this high intracranial pressure. We can give some drugs, we can do some manipulation with a ventilator, but at a stage there is nothing else to do, and we need to do this life-saving procedure, which is the hemicranectomy, where we lift the bone flap and we don't put it back, so sort of give space and time for the brain to heal and to swell. And so when you are at that stage, then you have this really severe brain injury. And as we know from a lot of studies, that patients that have ended up to that stage, there is only 5 to 10% who really recover well from this other scale that we have, that we grade. There's a spectrum from that to very good recovery, and only a small percent of these patients ended up with this good high functioning recovery. So I'm amazed by such as your story and the patient that I meet, that we have this group of patients that do this fantastic journey. So the essence of my research is to try understand how this happens and why, and can we learn something from that to, help others?
You know, that's phenomenal, your passion and the difference. You can tell by your tone how much you really love what you do, and it's more of a hobby with continuing to help others. And one of the questions I wanted to ask, after you just mentioned with the 5 to 10% outcome of having a positive result after a, not only a brain injury in general, but also with a severe traumatic brain injury where you have to take the craniectomy, why is there a difference in recovering following TBI between people with a similar type of injury?
So, we know, we know a lot, that there are very important factors that can affect this. For example, how bad your injury is from the beginning, what type of injury you had, how old you are. So there are some very specific factors that can affect if you survive those first days or weeks following your injury. What we know little of is when you follow these patients for a longer time, say several years, and you meet these people and they show such a huge difference, what that depends on. So in my research, which the understanding of this predisposition to good or bad outcome, started in one of my PhD studies with Jordan Grafman at NIH, who performed this fantastic study with the Vietnam Veterans Head Injury Study, where they follow up these veterans for 40 years. And he and David Goldman at NIH were, one of those first to actually starting to look at the genetic impact following outcome in TBI. And what is very excellent with that research is also that they have followed them up for 40 years, and they performed this large cognitive test battery. So you really assess the plasticity and the cognitive measure of these patients. And one of my studies was using different types of genes and looking at how it affects the cognitive performance after 3 decades of injury. And we could see that the BDNF always seemed to play this important role. And that's what I have been continuing when doing in my research in Sweden. So at Uppsala, we have this large TBI registry where we follow up TBI patients. Because usually when you are a neurosurgeon, you don't see the TBI patient after they leave the neurointensive care. Mm-hmm. You know, so we take care of the urgent thing with angel kenepusher and other stuff. But when they don't need the neurointensive care anymore, they are admitted to other wards and neurorehabilitation. And we usually don't see them, but we follow up our patients 6 to 12 months after that. And in my study, we try to do that even longer, up to 5 years. So when I try to include people for my study, I met some of them that was after 5 years of their injury.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that really made me, become enthusiastic about this even more, and I wanted to understand this, was that I actually met another patient with a similar story of you. And this was a guy that was playing hockey and a professional at a professional level. And he was playing this game that was recorded, so you could actually see the time he got his traumatic brain injury. And he got this severe tackling during the game, mm-hmm. and became immediately unconscious. And I was actually the one who performed the surgery when he was admitted. So I was going through the chart, and I saw that he was getting a surgery, and then he was treated for several weeks at our department. And when he left the department, he had hemiparesis. He was weak on one side of his body. He could not talk and he could not eat. So I, after 5 years, when I wanted to meet him again, I expected that he would, maybe come in a wheelchair or have some assistance of some sort. So I said his name, and then this guy just walking to my office. He was walking with no problem, talking with no problem. And what he said that was amazing for me was he was living independently, had his girlfriend, but also that he went to university for 4 to 5 years and was had his graduation and was starting to work. And I was so amazed that not only you go back to having a life without an assistant, but you can function cognitively that high at that level. And so I was very fascinated. I thought maybe this is just a coincidence, or, you know, I wanted to understand why. But we see that when we go through our data, that about 5 to 10% of these people have this type of recovery, that you have similar type of TBI, but some people recover very well. And I mean, we are in the beginning of understanding that genes do matter when it comes to plasticity, but it can also be other factors such as your, what we call some sort of cognitive reserve, what you have of course your age is important, but what type of level of performance maybe you have previously. So we are looking at all those factors now to try to understand why we get this superman or superwoman of traumatic brain injury. So we have both in my group and at our lab, we have studies that we do from, you know, cells to try mm-hmm. to look at this molecular mechanism that can have effect following nerve injuries, following injuries. And then we have animal models. And then we have also studies that we perform on patient, on human, in order to try to understand. So one of the cell studies that are very important is that we try to, for example, if we have a subject or this patient that has recovered as well, we do that with the technology and the methods that we have today. We can take a small piece of, biopsy from the skin or the blood sample, and then we can grow the nerve cells and glia cells of this patient, and then try to make this brain in a dish sort of experiments, or cells in the dish, and try to injure them and try to understand how they react differently than other patients who don't have this genetic variations that we suspect can play a major role in the recovery after TBI. And that's what we try to understand.
Wow. And that's not only very inspiring again with the story about the hockey player, but also how you're continuing to try to make a difference, not only short-term, but most importantly, long-term. One of the questions I also wanted to ask you with that change, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this already, but like we had discussed when we first connected, you were explaining more about the neuroplasticity making new connections to systematic adjustments, like literally remapping to improve the overall outcome of a brain injury.
You mean in the long term or in the acute phase?
I mean, in any phase. I know that, you know, there is definite individualized therapy and steps that will really help someone mm-hmm. get to where hopefully they can achieve. But I know, like when we had previously discussed, that there is some studies to try to make a more long-term difference with brain injuries.
Yes. So we know that, for example, different substances like drugs that we test and or exercise that others have shown that it can affect different people differently when it comes mm-hmm. to neuroplasticity. And when it comes to, you know, right now we don't have any pharmacological treatment for TBI. I mean, we have 30 failed clinical trials that have not been successful. And there are many reasons for that, I believe. But the reason I think is that it's like we try to take all cancers and treat them with this magic bullet, you know, that the drug that we have. But TBI is very heterogeneous, so we have to be very more precise in how we select our patient and based on that use the different substance that we want to try. And so what we see from our studies, but also from the animal studies and studying the cell, is that dependent on the variation in the genes, there is a difference between how you both what happens both in the early phase, but also in the late phase following TBI. So I definitely think that there is a variation how the neurons in some people connect compared to others that don't, because when we talk about more the chronic phase neuro rehabilitation, this is something that goes on for several years. So it's not about only this first week following TBI. There is happening these changes in the connectivity during a very long time. And what we also want to understand, do we need to have a very patient-specific rehab strategy that some people maybe need some sort of a rehab more or intensity, et cetera. That's also one thing that had not been really looked at when you try to understand why some people recover better than others. Mm-hmm. And I think we are more and more move towards the idea, the thinking of that we should use precision medicine in TBI because patients are so heterogeneous and their injuries are heterogeneous. And we are already, at the hospital in the neurointensive care bedside, we do take each patient, make a judgment individually and treat them individually. But we have not really taken that into consideration when it comes to guidelines or rehab strategies. And my hope is that we in the coming future can have very specific tailored treatment options for TBI patients. That's when you come into the neurointensive care based on some very important parameters that we register and the data that we gather, we can tailor a treatment of strategy in the neurointensive care unit, but also after that the patient leaves the neurointensive care, what is needed, because it's it's a long, I usually tell my patients and their relatives that it's not a sprint, this is a marathon you're in. So mm-hmm. you cannot just focus on this first week or the next 2 months. it's a long run, and we see things happening for a very long period of time after the TBI. And what is really unfortunate now that I'm working on is that the only thing that we can really say to the patient or the relatives is that, okay, time will tell, right? Because
right.
There is no prognostic model today that can say, okay, after maybe 1 month, 1 week or 1 month, this is where this patient will be in 6 months or 2 years. And it is a limitation that we have, and it both for, you know, the healthcare, the rehab strategy, for our stratification in the clinical trials to select patients, but most importantly for the patient and their family to be able to give them some sort of a prognosis of where will this lead, you know, where will this patient person be in 2 years or 5 years. So I'm really hoping that we are trying to get there. So I mean, one of the things we do is that we try to use artificial intelligence in order to process and all this information. I mean, you know yourself, and you've been experiencing this in the neurointensive care, that there is so much data that we gather. You know, mm-hmm. we have everything about the patient, and then all these physiological data from the rest of the body, but also from the brain. We collect everything, and it's really a large set of data for the clinician at the bedside to process. I mean, we do that very well, of course, but we could improve that so much more. So my hope is that we can at least be able to say more than, you know, currently the prognostic calculators that we have, they will give you this, okay, will the patient die or survive, or, you know, have very severe disabilities, but nothing more. And there's a large spectrum, right? So I can live at home with assistant, or I can work, or I can, so we need to be more precise. And I'm really hoping that the new methods and tools that we have today will just improve that.
I agree. And like you had stated, not only there's so many different underlying pathologies that have to go with any form of a brain injury, and of course having the support of AI in today's world and using all of that data is definitely helping at the beginning stage. But most importantly, time will tell, especially how no brain injuries are the same. That'd be exactly. Kind of like signifying you could cure all types of cancer with one magic bullet. To an extent, you can cure them, but nonetheless, every individual's personality, their journey is all going to be different. The only similarity is the injury or the stage that they have to go through.
Exactly.
You know, one thing that definitely helps when you mention neurointensive care, which is common for all brain injuries, is I wanted to ask you and get some information about neuromonitoring. That is a very important stage in brain injuries, and I think that you have some phenomenal information about that as well.
Yeah, so neuromonitoring has really changed neurointensive care since the beginning of the, actually you could say 90s, because we have become very good at the acute phase of neurotrauma. The survival has increased, and so it's have really helped the doctor that treat the patient, but also, of course, most importantly, the patient. So in the neurointensive care, what we can do if the patient is unconscious, that we have to monitor the brain in order to understand where it's going, because you get the injury, some cells die, but then we want to prevent the viable cells and the rest of the brain get any further injury. So that's the goal of the neurointensive care, neuromonitoring, to prevent things getting worse or new bad things happening to the brain of the patient. So, and we have this during the last decades, we have also probes or catheters that can monitor the brain oxygen, the brain metabolism, and the brain metabolism is monitored by this microdialysis catheter, which is actually a fantastic tool that has been teaching us a lot about the injured brain. And actually my first supervisor at KI when I started as a student was Professor Urban Ungerstedt, who was this phenomenal professor at Karolinska, and it was his invention that he developed this catheter that or membrane which sits on this catheter that can be placed in any tissue of the body. But we worked at the brain and brain injury, and the first patient who received this microdialysis catheter in the brain was a patient at Uppsala Hospital during the 90s. And then there are several more, of course, many clinics in the world, in the developed world, who also use this and monitor the brain of the injured the patient with traumatic brain injury. And what the goal in the beginning was, and still is to some extent, it tried to detect things before they happen. And the goal in the beginning was to detect ischemia. So when you get a warning signal that, okay, something is happening here, and you try to be able to prevent it and rescue that viable brain tissue. And but you can do a lot of other things also with this microdialysis, that you monitor different types of protein. And so it has been a fantastic tool to use when it comes in the field of TBI. And as I said previously, we get so much information from these neuromonitoring that we have in the NICU, and we need to be able to process it much better, and not just the way we do right now, that we do studies afterwards, but if we could have these tools that we can bedside visualize and use the data that's been you know, continuously collected. So, and that's one of my hopes, that we can be able to use the technology that we have today in order to improve that.
I agree, and it will continue to improve. And of course, when there's people behind the wheel like yourself, it's going to continue to move forward much more than we could ever determine or even imagine.
I'm really hoping that, because as you know, TBI is really a global issue. Mm-hmm. That and in particular in the developing world, you know, as soon as there is more traffic or use of motor vehicles, etc. These severe types of TBI increases. They decrease in some part of the world, but increase in other parts of the world. And then we have also this growing, actually maybe not growing in that sense. I think we always have had, for example, mild TBI issues, but we are getting more aware of it, and we are maybe diagnosing it in some bigger extent than we did previously. And I just hope that we can also provide more help to patients, that we get more tools, and also maybe more pharmacological treatment that we can help patients with the recovery after TBI.
I agree, and I definitely think, like we had mentioned before, with the continuous rise in technology and AI, and of course, brain injuries being addressed to where they're not something listed as rare or even a headache. When you have it happening, as we've known for generations, anywhere, anytime, and anyone. But again, with this continuous outreach and individuals like yourself that I mentioned behind the wheel, we're letting people know not only how truly, unfortunately, common it is to sustain a brain injury, but how it's not the end of the road. There are different ways that are continuing to change to help the individual and, of course, their family move forward at whatever is best given to them at that time. But most importantly, how it's ending this silent epidemic, and especially letting people know in the military format that they are also sustaining brain injuries. It's not just from an accident or sport related.
No, exactly. You know, it's so fascinating when you mention the military, because part of my PhD, I did have some projects with blast TBI that really became into focus when the Iraq-Afghanistan veterans came back to USA. And, you know, when I am born in Iran, so I'm a refugee. So I was, when I was 5-6 years old, the Iran and Iraq war was ongoing. And I remember that we had people we know, relatives, men, of course, that they behaved strange. You know, they have this, if they had an outrage, anger management or some behavioral that was not socially acceptable, and people were really understanding, and they called them, okay, just leave him be, because he's, they called him Moji, which means that they are hit by the wave. And when I did my PhD, I just had this reflection that, you know, this has been known, although at that moment you read the history, like the shock wave and that kind of thing, that it has been known, but it just struck me that people knew, okay, that there is something with the wave that these soldiers have been hit by, and they suffer this consequences of this wave that hit them. They are not injured, as you can see, and but something happened to their brain, and this has been known, and we just have not talked about it in that sense. And I was really fascinating that this veterans from in the U.S. brought this really to light, that there is something that happens to our brain, even though you cannot see it when it comes to, you know, there is not a visible injury, and it is categorized as mild, but we are trying to, we are understanding it more, but, you know, it's been going on for so many years, ever since war have been existing, but it's just during the last decade or so we are giving it more attention. And of course it's the same thing with athletes, you know, that suffer from this repetitive mild TBI that can really give very severe and bad consequences, of course, later in life.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, of course, how long it's been going on, but again, with, like we've been discussing, with the continuous rise in education, technology, and once again, individuals like you behind the wheel, it's making a positive change, not only for the future, but it's also ending the silent epidemic that occurs more than any form of cancer, and unfortunately takes more lives every single day with a brain injury.
Yes, thank you for saying that, and I'm so happy that there are you know, people like you who have had this journey, and take this, it takes a lot of time and energy, but you try to spread the knowledge, spread your experience, and, you know, give hope to people who've been suffering from this, because I, you know, I have relatives and patients sometimes, I think maybe we are a little bit not so good maybe in Sweden, I don't know, but they usually ask, I mean, can I read a book, or do you, can I talk to someone, because they, when you go through something like that, you need to share your experience. You want to understand, you want to see if, you know, what's happening to other people. So I think it's so important what you do. And I'm just so happy that I could talk to you and, you know, share my experience and hear more about you.
And thank you so much for your kind words, Dr. Rostami. And of course, your passion, once again, everything you do, it's an honor not only to connect with you, but also connect with you even more on tonight's show and help other individuals know more about you and the opportunities to enhance the difference with brain injury. For our listeners, do you have any websites or any information where if they have time, they can try to track you down and follow more of your work?
Absolutely. If they just Google my name, I think they will end up to come to webpage and have my email. So if they just Google Elham Rostami, I think they can find me.
Perfect. Well, we'll make sure to remind them of that. And I want to keep a really good impact with you and I and work more together to help move this brain injury silence forward and continuing to be that positive change. Once again, it's an honor to know you, learn more about you, and continue this conversation more in depth again tonight. So thank you for such a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you.
Before we wrap this up, and I'll let you get back to your inspirational time frame, do you have any questions for me?
Yes. And if you look at back at your time, for mm-hmm. example, in the hospital, or so do you have something to tell us that we could have done that, or if you hear from, you know, people in your situation, that we could have done differently to make the journey easier for you?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question for two things. One, first off, to answer that, there's really nothing different that could have been done. When I met a lot of survivors, caregivers, or even nurses, and especially doctors explaining or showing me their formula or what they've done, I would always trigger memories of myself and my time, and it was really amazing that was done. Not only, of course, every day with the schedule, but in all levels of nurses, time with my doctor, PT, OT, even just the intensive care they did for me, but also my family. So it's amazing what every level of hospital care is done for, once again, not only the patient, but also with their loved ones that are able to stop by or stay with them at any time frame. So thank you for all you guys do, not just you, but also your staff and every hospital and every nurse and doctor, et cetera, that is tuning in. You guys are the real superhero, Superman and Superwoman that really do not get enough credit and deserve more than anything.
Thank you.
And another thing I wanted to state is, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, ma'am.
No, I'm just so happy that you had this positive experience during your time at the hospital and after that. That's excellent. So the people around you worked really hard and good.
And they had a passion, just like yourself. And another thing I was referring to with that question, like you stated, how doctors really do not keep in touch with their patient when they're released, because doctors have a work ethic, they have other patients, and they have a style that they have to maintain. And individuals, when they get released from the hospital, they have to begin their, you know, their next stage of recovery. Either it's rehabilitation, go to another hospital, try to get back on their feet, etc. But I do keep in touch with my neurologists and my doctors from both stages, even my nurses from both stages of my hospital, and they have stated the same thing you stated. They said it's very rare. Again, it's not because they don't care, but it's because everyone has a format they have to get back into, both the professional and the non-professional.
Mm-hmm.
So having the ability to keep in contact with them, even though they're busy, but just to every once in a while, when, you know, I can stop by and see them, I can send them an email, or some have even given me their direct contact and I can shoot them a text, or they'll shoot me a text randomly. But it's just the ability to create that communication is phenomenal.
Oh yeah, that's fantastic.
Thank you, ma'am. But once again, it's phenomenal what you do. I'll make sure to send people your way to continue watching your thrive and the difference making you're doing for us TBI survivors, and of course the future of ending the silent epidemic, like we've mentioned numerous times. But I really do want to keep in touch, and if there's any way that my organization and or myself can do anything to help you personally and or your work, it would be an honor.
Thank you so much. I really hope that we can stay connected, and I'm really honored to be here, and thank you for reaching out, and let's just, you know, stay connected and try to make things better for all patients with TBI.
I agree. We'll definitely do that work together to make minds and lives more better, and we will definitely keep in touch, most importantly. Thank you for the honor, Dr. Rasami. You are phenomenal.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I hope you have a great rest of the day, and thank you once again.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Wow, everyone. What an amazing impact and show we just had with Dr. Rasami sharing her passion, her difference making, and the impact that she is working on to help brain injuries, not only globally, but with her environment over in Sweden. If you would like to learn more about her or even try to contact her, like she said, you can Google her name, but to help you simplify that even easier, please reach out to us and we will help you understand more about her work and also the difference making that she is behind the wheel in addressing brain injuries and most importantly, the outcome for everyone that sustains one, from athletes, individuals, and of course, veterans. Let's continue to follow the TBI One Love movement with all forms of social media and of course, find out more about us and our positive form of hope, inspiration, and education at tbionelove.org. Thanks again for being a part of our movement and painting the world green. One love.